The bus company Suburban Express is in trouble after an email ad that singled out Chinese students.
Seeing something so racist, something so explicitly racist, as an advertisement for a pretty prominent on-campus company, it was appalling.
That's a U of I student on WCIU. And speaking of ads, there's this.
A federal court has ordered Philip Morris USA, Laura Lard, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco, and Altria to make this statement about the addictiveness of smoking and nicotine. Cigarette companies intentionally design cigarettes with enough nicotine to create and sustain addiction.
We'll talk about these strange new anti-smoking ads running as the result of a long-contested settlement with Big Tobacco. But first, it's the time of year when you want to share with those who need it most, but how do you make sure your charity gifts are getting where they're needed? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. For many people, this time of year means giving, not just to friends and relatives, but to those in need. But you want to make sure you're getting the most for your dollars and that they're going to the right place. Just last month, the longtime Rockford-based veterans charity Viet Now was dissolved after engaging in fraud. Here's Attorney General Lisa Madigan speaking about it on the 21st.
Instead of the majority of money being used to go to veterans and helping support them, the vast majority of money, nearly 90% of it, in fact, was being retained by the professional fundraisers, as opposed to going to needed services for veterans.
So what can you do as a concerned donor if you want to give more smartly this holiday season? Joining me to help answer that question is Daniel Borikoff, the president of the independent watchdog organization Charity Watch, and Susie Lee, the director of strategic initiatives at Forefront, an association of philanthropies, nonprofits, and grantmakers that includes I'll Give as one of its major initiatives. Both are on the line from Chicago. Daniel, Susie, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Yes, hello. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. Daniel, Charity Watch is a resource for people who want to learn more about what they're supporting. What tips do you have to offer about specifically giving during the holidays?
Yeah, we're a really helpful resource. For instance, you opened the program with the Viet Now, and it's horrible. A lot of people had their money squandered that really, you know, deeply wanted to help veterans. But had they been using Charity Watch as a resource, we have been giving them an F grade as far back as 2001, so they would have avoided, you know, wasting their money. So we strongly encourage people to get some information before they give. I mean, most people base it just on what the appeal or solicitation itself says. And of course, the charity wants your money. So what we think is just vitally important is that you find out what the charity's actually doing with the money and who it's actually helping. And like with Viet Now, they did almost nothing for veterans, almost nothing to help veterans. In fact, in the latest 2016 period, Charity Watch found that only 4% of its money was going to programs. We think it should be 60% or more. The better groups are able to get 70, 75, 80% of their budget towards bona fide actual programs. And this is where it gets tricky for a donor, is the charities will claim that something's a program. Like, for instance, with veterans, they'll say that they're getting 90% to program. Sometimes when they do their manipulative reporting, which sometimes they do, and the accountants can sometimes sign off on it. But what you want to find out is what's a bona fide program. And so, what they could do is say that an appeal that tells you that injured veterans have needs, and that counts as a program. It's called joint cost allocation. So one of the, like a tip that Charity Watch does in its deeper level of analysis that's hard to find on the internet, there's a lot of robo ratings that, you know, out there, but what we'll actually do is we'll find out how much is a real program, how much money is going to bona fide programs that really help the veterans, rather than just tell us what we already know, that injured veterans have need in the appeal, and then people will think that that most of the money is going to real programs when it's not. So we have an A+ to F ratings based on the on the financial performance accountability. We also have governance and transparency and accountability measures at CharityWatch.org.
Well, so something you said really piqued my interest. You mentioned, you know, people base their giving on solicitations. I've had this experience where I make a contribution, then I get a ton of follow-up solicitations, usually direct mail, which I imagine is not cheap, and that can make me skeptical about what that organization is doing with my money. What do you think about my instincts on that? How does Charity Watch measure whether or not
your instincts are wise? In fact, I would base it more on instincts, and you can actually go to the go to websites, and we've got them listed at CharityWatch.org through the states, and find out the contract under which you're being solicited. So maybe there's like a 90-10 contract, or you know, where the charity's automatically giving 90% of the money raised to the fundraising company. We also tabulate the fundraising costs, like how much does it cost to raise $100. So we will, you know, we'll also make that, you know, available, and we encourage people to go to our top-rated list, and they can see the groups that are operating more efficiently.
All right, Susie, let's bring you into the conversation here. What is Forefront and I'll Give? That's hashtag I'll Give for people who aren't familiar with this.
Yeah, absolutely. As you mentioned, Forefront is a membership organization, so we serve the nonprofits and the grant makers all across Illinois. When we're working to build a vibrant social impact sector, part of that means a financially stable nonprofit. So Forefront's I'll Give campaign focuses on financial gifts. While, of course, it gives us all those warm, fuzzy feelings to give that winter coat or jars of peanut butter, we also know that nonprofits still have what we call the real costs of operating. They still need to pay for rent and keep the lights on, so those dollars are really important in terms of efficiency.
Yeah, so I mean, right, in terms of what people give, you know, people might think of clothing or canned food drives, but cash is really king for a lot of charities, right? I mean, is that what you hear from charities?
Definitely. Okay. So I'll give.com.
Yeah, international situation where people want to clean up their garages, and you know, there's a lot of money to it costs a lot to ship goods. And then you could clog supply lines, so it's certainly better that charities can do more with the cash, you know, use it for what they need most, so that, you know, and then help the local economy. So certainly it is better to send cash in most cases.
Sure. And Susie, you were trying to get in there too. Go ahead.
Yeah, Giving Tuesday and I'll Give, it's the fastest growing trend in giving. It's mostly online. Something that's nice about that, particularly the platform that we work with, there's an internal sort of vetting process. So there are social security numbers checked, organizations have to be registered with the state in good standing, so you have a certain amount of security built into that. And also, it provides you a great way to get to know your nonprofits. Similar to what Daniel mentioned, we know that two-thirds of people who make donations do no research at all before they give. Sometimes that's okay. Folks are giving to a nonprofit they already know or was recommended by a friend. But if you're a first-time donor and you do want to do some research, I'll Give, ilgive.com, has a search option. You can search by city, by cause, and find something you're deeply connected to, whether it's animal welfare, the arts, social justice, something that matches your interest, that's local, that you can connect to them on a real relationship level. It's kind of like speed dating for nonprofits.
Yeah. So, Susie, I want to ask you, so I mean, we're talking about this idea of year-end giving. Does Forefront see any trends? Do people tend to focus their gifts in certain areas?
We know that 30% of all donations are made in either November or December. In fact, December 31st and Giving Tuesday are the biggest giving days of the year. A lot of that goes to human interest groups, and we know that nonprofits really depend on that trend. That's sort of been baked into the nonprofit sector for decades.
So is that a challenge for nonprofits to get so much of their money at this time of year?
Most nonprofits set up their financial planning and their resources to be ready for this time of year. However, it is something we consider. A lot of nonprofits have had the end-of-year giving, as well as, you know, the golf outings and the annual galas, which are fun and engaging, but they're not as engaging to younger donors that are starting to really get involved with nonprofits. So I'll Give and Giving Tuesday, which is mostly online, those are really great ways to connect with communities in a way they never have before. And we're actually looking for opportunities to spread that out across the year. So, for example, in May of 2018, we'll have an All Give that's focused on local communities all across the state. Because when you think about it, if you're looking to buy a pair of jeans or a hamburger, you don't think about it once a year. You think about it pretty regularly, and you're asked to pick out a pair of jeans or a hamburger all the time.
So that's Susie Lee of Forefront. I'm Brian Mackey. You're listening to The 21st, where we're talking about year-end giving. We also have on the line Daniel Borokoff of Charity Wash. Daniel, I want to return to you. So, like I said, year-end giving, for people who want to make a gift, have no idea where to start, and specifically thinking of this, you know, holiday season of giving, right? What do you recommend, Daniel? How do people get started with this?
Well, at CharityWatch.org, we've listed our top-rated groups that primarily get A and B grades. I mean, there's a lot of D's and F's that have very similarly sounding names, so you got to be careful and pay attention. But, you know, a lot of it's like playing, you know, you're somewhat playing God. I mean, what do you really care about? What are you really passionate about? And when you get a call or a letter, let yourself be inspired, but you don't have to give to the first person that asks. I mean, the number one reason why Americans give is because they're asked by a charity or someone, and you got to take a step further and look at what they're really doing and how they're spending their, you know, and how they're spending their money. And there's, you know, certainly there's lots of information available on the internet, you know, from the groups. You can give directly. There's a lot of vehicles, you know, you can, you know, give through other places, but there's a risk that they take a big haircut. So it's certainly better if you can go directly, but you got to make sure that the group is actually, you know, one that you would believe, you know, that has a track record, a history of being able to help. And, you know, it's good to give local, but you also need to give national. I know a lot of us are trying to recover from all those horrible disasters. I mean, both some people physically when their house was flooded, but other people emotionally, and it's tragic and it's horrible, but there's still a lot of needs that aren't big in the news. There's a lot of individuals that aren't doing well in our economy with the haves and the have-nots. So I think a lot of times this time of year, people care more about their fellow person, and they want to think about the, you know, the social and human service charities that are really helping people. And then there's just a lot of atrocities in the world, such as what's happening in Yemen and Syria and the Bangladesh, the Rohingya. And, you know, we just, you know, don't forget about that. So sometimes you need to step up and do more than you ordinarily would. And this would be a year. So I don't want to see people get burnt out from those, from the hurricane, you know, the three big hurricanes that came up in the Caribbean and Texas and Florida. But think about some of the other groups that, you know, that may have gotten neglected that are also really important with helping people.
Yeah, right. So you mentioned, you know, we have these one-time natural disasters, but there's still a lot of need that maybe doesn't generate the amount of headlines. Do you think people should create sort of annual relationships with philanthropies, or do you have to research starting from scratch every year? Do charities get better and worse over time?
Well, charities need long, loyal-time supporters in order to survive. So it's good to have some to be able to stay with. People do like to switch around a lot, but it is helpful. And then, you know, but they do need to be monitored because some of them, you know, may fall off and not do what they say that they're doing. And we just put a Hot Topic alert about a group called Wonder Work that we encourage people to look at. They raised money under a lot of different names, and the CEO was like, you know, forced to resign for a lot of bad, you know, for a lot of alleged abuses. And so people do need to stay with it and watch these charities, you know, not just put it on autopilot and give automatically. I mean, because they are run by people, and sometimes the people do a great job and sometimes people do a not so great job.
Mm-hmm. So Susie, we heard a moment ago Daniel was talking about the natural disasters, the hurricane relief. People have given money for that. We're also coming into the time of year when politicians are asking for money, and you know, political causes have been a hot topic this year. Susie, do you think folks are getting tapped out, or does giving beget more giving?
You know, there have been a number of studies in the last several years about significant natural disasters. And to see what kind of impact they have on regular end-of-year giving, in most cases, there hasn't been a significant decrease. This time of year, many people, especially in America, are feeling the generosity of the season. You know, we're sort of in giving mode. It's giving time, giving our talent, and, when possible, financial gifts.
So giving, I guess, you know, is this, it does beget more giving, right? We're going to, we see things, are things looking up this year? Do, I mean, is there an outlook for charities as you know, we're coming into the end of 2017?
Well, we just finished Giving Tuesday and the I'll Give campaign here in Illinois, and I'll certainly say it was a really positive campaign for us at Forefront, as well as the 467 organizations that successfully raised funds. We had a 100% increase over last year, nearly 10,000 individual donors, many of them that had donated for the very first time ever. So it's a really powerful tool to engage folks digitally, especially younger donors, but engaging their communities like they've never done before to really grow the sector.
Daniel, we've only got about a minute left. You know, just want to wrap up this idea of holiday giving. You know, what are the pitfalls people should avoid here? You know, are they in a rush to cross things off their list? Maybe they're giving too emotionally.
Oh, well, you know, certainly, you know, if a friend makes a suggestion, particularly with social media being so popular, there's a lot of crowdfunding, Indiegogo, GoFundMe, these kind of things. Unless you really know and respect and trust the people, it's not the same as giving to a charity. There's very little oversight or accountability there. There's no filing of reports or follow-up. So it's really risky. So give to a charity that has a good track record, that's operating efficiently, that's well governed, that's being transparent, that has a high rating from Charity Watch. Would strongly mm-hmm. encourage that. There are a lot of traps, and some things can look great. You know, any charity, no matter how bad it is, can look great in a solicitation on their website. But you got to go deeper, and you know, most people just don't take that extra step. But you really could risk throwing away your money unless you do some research, and it doesn't take it doesn't take as much.
I'm afraid we have to leave it there. That's Daniel Borokoff of Charity Watch. We also spoke with Susie Lee of Forefront. This is the 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. Every holiday season, thousands of students across Illinois pile onto buses headed for the Chicago area, whether it's to the suburbs or to the airport, as step one in a longer journey home. One company that runs some of these buses has gotten into trouble recently. This past weekend, Suburban Express sent out email ads to try to get more people to ride their buses. One thing they promoted, quote, "Passengers like you, you won't feel like you're in China when you're on our buses." That's a clear reference to Chinese students at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, who make up 12% of the total student population. This angered a lot of people. It's got national attention. And in response, well, let's say it took Suburban Express a few tries to issue an apology. In one instance, they criticized the U of I for admitting lots of international students and said it's tantamount to, quote, "selling our university to the highest foreign bidder." And after all of that, by Monday, Attorney General Lisa Madigan said she would launch a civil rights inquiry into Suburban Express. We'll get into the civil rights inquiry in a few minutes, but first I'm joined by Brian Moline, managing editor at Illinois Public Media. Brian, remind us, what happened here? We mentioned that the email ad by Suburban Express came out on Sunday. What was the response, especially on social media?
Well, Brian, as you might imagine, a lot of negative response on social media, a lot of negative comments to the company's Facebook page, there was a hashtag Suburban Express on Twitter that was trending as well with a lot of negative comments about what the company had sent out. Plus, the University of Illinois campus here has a very active Reddit community, and there were several threads on Reddit talking about this issue, and as you might expect, in a very negative fashion as well.
So, and then they issued a, well, it was titled an apology, but it wasn't quite that. What did they say in their first response?
Well, let me just read a little bit from that first email that was titled apology. It said, quote, "We made a remark based on the fact that our competitor," most likely referring to Peoria Charter right there, "mostly handles Chinese international students. The remark is being interpreted as a slap in the face of all non-Caucasians for some reason, and that is not how it was intended." Then, as you mentioned in the introduction there, Brian, they went on to talk about how they disagree how the University of Illinois has been increasing enrollment from international students over the last several years. So, yeah, it was titled apology, but I don't think you could really say it was that.
So how has the University of Illinois responded to this?
The university issued a statement on Monday and basically condemning the emails that Suburban Express had sent out. It was signed by three University of Illinois administrators here on the Urbana campus. That statement is posted to the university's student affairs website. One thing that they said was that the emails from Suburban Express were, quote, "in direct opposition to the values of this university."
Okay. Joining us now is Omotola Okuba. She's the public relations manager for Suburban Express, and she joins us now by phone. The quote we just heard, "passengers like you won't feel like you're in China when you're on our buses," that's been widely read as discriminatory, even racist language. How does Suburban Express respond to those complaints?
Hi. First of all, we removed the individual from being able to make emails or interact with students, and I have replaced the individual immediately. We strive for inclusion, and there is no racist the racist tone was meant as a jab at humor, an attempt at humor. Perhaps in an older generation it would have been more widely accepted, but as a new generation we have strived to make sure that all students and all jokes made towards race has been will be condemned and not repeated. And so I'm glad for the student outcry, and I'm glad that Suburban Express is actively doing something to rectify the situation and openly pursuing opportunities to make amends.
So it sounds like you're saying that this email that went out is, you know, was not meant to be in the voice of the company. It wasn't the owner who wrote that.
It was the owner, but it was his attempt at humor for the holidays, and it was taken in appropriately in the wrong manner because it was it openly objectified a certain demographic, Chinese American students or Chinese foreign students, and it was his attempt at humor. However, his sense of humor is not widely accepted. It is one from a much older generation, and also sort of like, if you've seen the show Big Bang Theory, like Sheldon Cooper, where a notable genius but socially awkward individual tries to use humor to gain acceptance, but it doesn't always work out correctly. And I feel like that's what happened in this situation.
So you say the person has been removed, obviously not from the company. I guess you mean from the marketing aspect of the
exactly.
company or something? Okay. Exactly. I mean, what does Suburban Express do to try and rebuild its relationship with its customer base?
They've hired a new PR person, which is me. I am a minority myself, so I'm openly aware of diversity and inclusion. And I feel as though it's now more important than ever that we make sure that everyone knows that we do include all students. No student is turned away based off of race, sexual orientation, or gender, or any sort of identifiable objects. They're not turned away for any reason. If they buy an honest ticket, they are allowed to board the bus. There's no racist practices in purchasing a ticket or boarding the bus. It was a joke that was in poor taste, and we do apologize sincerely for that.
Okay. The last thing I want to ask you, have you talked with anyone from the state about the civil rights inquiry?
We're reaching out with them currently.
Okay. That's Omotola Okuba. She's the public relations manager for Suburban Express. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
I'm Brian Mackey. You're listening to The 21st. Also joining us is Xiaoyao Qian. He's a master's student at the University of Illinois studying computer science. He's originally from Shanghai and has lived in Champaign for the last 7 years. Xiaoyao, I want to ask, how did you come across this bus ad by Suburban Express? Where did you first see it?
So I first see it on my on WeChat. That's a social media app that is very popular among Chinese students and Asian students. So there's like one day I find like everybody is on my timeline are sharing this piece of news. It was basically a screenshot of the campaign email from Suburban Express, and later another screenshot from their titled apology email. And this just goes viral on the timeline, and everybody's is complaining and, you know, like saying, you know, stating opinions about Suburban Express.
So, you mentioned WeChat. This is a Chinese social media app. If people aren't familiar with it, I think there's 900 million users every day around the world. But what was your personal reaction? What did you think when you first read this ad?
I'm very astonished to read this piece of news, because this is not the first time that Suburban Express has made such kind of statements or behavior in the past 7 years.
And you just heard from Suburban Express. Their spokeswoman was on the phone with us. What do you think about what you heard from them?
I think at least the representative from Suburban Express is moving the situation towards a better direction than their apology email that is sent before. But I think there are something that is different from, I quoted the Sheldon Cooper situation, because I've watched all like 10 seasons of Big Bang Theory, and Sheldon Cooper only like made those kind of jokes to close friends. But this is like a public email and campaign that is addressing a big mass of students from the University of Illinois, and I don't think that is appropriate way to express a joke or something like that.
So I'm glad you picked up on that, because that reference was admittedly lost on me. So thank you for explaining that to our listeners who are, you know, maybe less pop culture savvy than I am. Thinking, though, of when you first saw the follow-up from Suburban Express, right, this is the one called Apology, but it actually criticized the U of I for admitting more and more students from China, saying that U of I management was basically selling the university to the highest foreign bidder and placing burdens on domestic students. Xiaoyao, what was your reaction to that?
Well, I think that is not true, and that is very the writer of that email is just looking at this issue from a very extreme perspective, because I don't think this is a bidding. It's because like all the students are admitted to University of Illinois with the same level of standard. You know, we also took like SAT or GRE exams. We also had to present our qualification to be able to further study and gain achievements in the University of Illinois and also United States. So I don't think it's a bidding. It's totally different.
Brian Moline, I want to bring you back into this conversation. As we mentioned, Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan said her office is launching a civil rights inquiry into Suburban Express. Yesterday, you interviewed Karen Bass Ehler, the head of the Attorney General's Civil Rights Bureau. Let's listen to a little bit of what she had to say.
It is a violation of our public accommodations laws to limit an individual's access to spaces of public accommodation, such as buses, airports, airplanes, train stations, restaurants, hotels, other places of public accommodation, based on an individual's either race, national origin, gender, and in Illinois, sexual orientation and gender identity as well.
So, Brian, as far as you can tell, why is the state's top law enforcement official getting involved? What's her office's role here?
Well, they're looking to see if this is part of a pattern of behavior from Suburban Express. And I should mention, this isn't the first time that the company has run into trouble. Several years ago, actually, the company had filed about 120 small claims lawsuits against customers that they say had violated their terms and conditions. Now, those lawsuits were later dropped, but as you can see, this company has gotten into trouble with its customers before. This is a little bit different, though, in the fact that, that the company, you know, really seemed to be targeting a specific population with its email communication to customers. And so I think what the Attorney General's office is looking for is to seeing, you know, does that communication, for instance, make Chinese students feel unwelcome, uncomfortable in using Suburban Express? And if so, that certainly could be a violation of the Illinois Human Rights Act.
Brian, you also asked Karen Bass-Ehler what the Attorney General's office was looking at during this inquiry. Let's hear what she had to say.
We look at a variety of different pieces in terms of requesting documents, such as the sort of communications that a company has with the general public, the sort of advertisements that they communicate to the general public. The Human Rights Act is pretty specific about the kind of advertisements a company can use and put in place to make sure that individuals do not feel dissuaded from taking certain carriers simply based on the color of their skin, their religion, their gender, sexual orientation.
So, Brian, what kind of documents is the Attorney General's office looking for?
Well, certainly they'll be looking at previous advertisements that the company has used, both you know, emails sent out to their customers and other advertisements posted publicly, whether that's, you know, billboards, et cetera. So they'll be looking at those. They'll also be, you know, looking at, you know, I would imagine they're subpoenaed, you know, email communication with individual customers as well. As mentioned, this is a company that has had different issues with customers over the years. In fact, their owner was arrested a few years ago for online harassment, you know, sending an email to a customer that could be construed as threatening. So they're looking for a pattern here. They're looking for, you know, different interactions with customers and their advertisements. So those are the types of things that that the AG's office is looking at.
So what steps could Attorney General Madigan's office take, Brian, depending on what they find? I mean, are there penalties possible here?
Oh yeah, there are some pretty harsh penalties. If the company is found to have violated the Illinois Human Rights Act, the fine there is $10,000 per violation. So, you know, we could be talking about a significant sum of money, and, you know, this is not a huge business. You know, this is, you know, a business where tens of thousands of dollars in fines certainly could hurt Suburban Express.
So I'd like to welcome someone else into this conversation. Tuat Lay is the Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. She's on the line with us from her office in Chicago. Tuat, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thank you very much.
So Tuat, from your perspective, this was clearly an offensive comment, quote, passengers like you won't feel like you're in China. Why do you think the government is getting involved in this?
Well, I think as you know, your conversation earlier is that the government has an interest in making sure that people are not discriminated against, right? And so that's why we have these laws to protect people. And, you know, I think that the United States, as a place that wants to welcome people, I think there's just an overall interest, both from the AG as the state, as well as possibly the city of Chicago.
And this ad was singling out students who came to the University of Illinois from China. Suburban Express seems surprised that a lot of other people were also offended by it. But I wonder, for you as an Asian American and someone involved in Asian American activism, what was your reaction to it?
Yeah, I think it's it was shocking, but also very befuddling, right? And I think the AG looking into this is the right thing, because in my view, I don't know how a bus company can make a claim like that without some sort of mechanisms to discriminate against Chinese students, right? How can they even try to ensure that somebody, whatever like them, looks like, would be sitting next to them? Right. And so I think whether in advertising or even like creating a hostile environment where student riders are not using that bus company anymore, I think those types of practices need to be called into question.
So I think we're going to take a short break here. We want to stick with this conversation. That was Tuat Lay from the Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. We're talking about Suburban Express, a bus company that has gotten some negative public attention for an ad that a lot of people are calling racist. We're going to talk more about that after the break. You're listening to The 21st. We'll be right back.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. We're going to continue our conversation about Suburban Express. It's a bus company. This past week, they've gotten a lot of negative attention for an ad. They sent out an email ad that said, quote, you won't feel like you're in China when you're on our buses. It was a clear reference to Chinese students at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We're speaking with Tuet Lay, of the Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. I'm wondering, you were listening when Suburban Express was on with us a little while ago. What do you think about their response that this comment was an attempt at humor?
Yeah, actually, I had a lot of reactions to that because I found it very problematic for several reasons. One, I think trying to pass this off as a different generation's humor, I am pretty much that person's age, the owner's age, not that much younger. And my generation does not have that sense of humor. So I just don't find that passes. I also think that you know, the humor part has to have sort of an underlying truth, right? That's what works about humor. And so, you know, I think it reveals a lot about how the owner feels about people. And then his so-called apology only underlines that, right? Where, you know, the students are called a burden on what he refers to as domestic students, right? Which is just code word for white students. And so I think these are just very thinly veiled. And then finally, this whole idea of comparing himself to Sheldon Cooper and Doc Martin, as I saw in one of the articles, these are characters, first of all. And this idea is that they are not actually being humorous. They are blunt and awkward, and we laugh at that. But he is trying to say that his awkwardness is his humor, right? That his racism is his humor and his attempt at humor. Those characters are not trying to be funny. This is just who they are, and that they're too blunt for, you know, to be acceptable in society, right? So I just don't find that any of these excuses that they're using are acceptable.
Mm-hmm. What have you been hearing from others in the Asian American community, especially in Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten a lot of calls about this for sure, right? And I think it's one of those things that is just incredible in this day and age that this is, you know, something that not only that people are still feeling, but also feel that they can put out publicly, and that that it's acceptable. But I think it's also, you know, people wondering whether in this sort of new era that we're entering over this last year, whether this is just people feeling free to openly express hostility to Asian Americans, but also, you know, foreign students or immigrants, right? I mean, this is a growing trend across the country.
That's Tuet Lay with Asian Americans Advancing Justice. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you very much.
I want to go now back to Xiaoyao Qian. He's a graduate student at the University of Illinois. We spoke with him a little bit earlier about this ad from Suburban Express. You also got to hear, Xiaoyao, what Suburban Express had to say. I wonder, you know, what do you hope to see from this company in the future?
I think they should definitely stop making those kind of statements anymore. And there are also like a lot of things that they can improve on, I think. So from what you also said about their owners, they have histories about publicly bashing students and passengers online, and I think that's a fundamental corporate culture issue, and I think they should probably adjust their culture. And also like adapt to the modern technologies. By that, what I mean is, like, for example, I know a lot of students are complaining about Suburban Express is that when they trying to onboard the bus, they just forgot to print out their ticket. They actually bought the ticket. They can present it on their phone, but they just forgot to print it, and they got denied to they're rejected to on the bus. So I think that's also like something they can improve definitely, and a better like customer service regarding, you know, late buses and also refunds. These are all the kinds of things I can think of. Of a good, like, you know, transportation company.
Sounds like basically get with the times here. It sounds like what you're saying.
Exactly.
All right. Well, that's Xiaoyao Chen. He is a graduate student in computer science at the University of Illinois. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks also to Brian Moline of Illinois Public Media for sharing some of his reporting on this subject. I'm Brian Mackey. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you've watched primetime television recently, perhaps you were surprised by this commercial. It's a plain white screen, black text, and this voice.
A federal court has ordered Philip Morris USA, Laura Lard, RJ Reynolds Tobacco, and Altria to make this statement about the addictiveness of smoking and nicotine. Smoking is highly addictive. Nicotine is the addictive drug in tobacco. Cigarette companies intentionally design cigarettes with enough nicotine to create and sustain addiction. It's not easy to quit. When you smoke, the nicotine actually changes the brain. That's why quitting is so hard.
That's one example of a few anti-smoking ads that are now running on television and in certain newspapers. You can see one in this Sunday's Chicago Tribune. And believe it or not, they're more than a decade in the making. That's because they're the result of a 2006 judicial ruling in a lawsuit filed by the federal government that found that tobacco companies intentionally misled the public about the dangers of smoking. But because of multiple appeals, they're only now running. So, how effective are these ads? And after a decade, is this old news? Erica Sward is Assistant Vice President of National Advocacy at the American Lung Association. She's on the line from Washington, D.C. And John Wirtz is an Assistant Professor in the Department of Advertising at the University of Illinois. He's in our Urbana studio. Erica, John, welcome to The 21st. Erica, you were involved with this case since 2005. Can you help us understand the timeline of this ad up until now?
The American Lung Association and other members of the public health community asked the federal judge overseeing this case, Judge Kessler, for intervention status. We essentially wanted to become part of the case in 2005 when it became clear to us that the federal government at the time was not representing the best interests of the American public when it came to resolving the case, but more importantly, really looking at the remedies on how to prevent the industry from continuing to act in a way that would violate RICO law moving forward. And so we became parties in 2005, and then in the summer of 2006, Judge Kessler issued her ruling, and she also determined that the industry would need to run corrective statements so that the public could be informed about what the truth actually is about the industry's long history of fraud and deception. And that, she said, was because there's a likelihood that present and future violations for the RICO statute would continue. So at that time, she ordered the corrective statements. And really, we've been spending, as you said, the last 11 years fighting in court with the industry about what exactly those statements would say. And so that's why, as we look to all of these, that they may seem a little different than we might think in a 2017 world.
Yeah. So we are in 2017. Is this information news to people about smoking tobacco?
Well, it's still very relevant and very true, because despite their claims to the contrary, the tobacco companies that Judge Kessler found guilty have not changed. I think their continued aversion to telling the truth is clear from how far and how hard they fought the corrective statements, and even going so far as to convincing the judge that here is the truth should come out from these ads at the very beginning. So, you know, we have to remember that they are in the cigarette selling business as well as other tobacco products, and they really do spend the bulk of it marketing to kids, the so-called replacement generation.
All right, well, let's talk about this ad. We heard a little bit at the beginning, Professor Wirtz. I want to ask you, it's a white screen, black words. It's hard to say if that's even really a human speaking. As somebody who teaches advertising, is this a good ad?
Well, I don't think the ad itself is designed to be a good ad. I think that the ad is, I kind of think of it when I heard and looked at the ads, kind of like the person that you hear about that takes, pays his taxes in pennies. You pay them, but you're making a statement by doing it. And the way that the ads are designed, it's clear that the cigarette companies, they know what they're doing. They're not stupid. Their ads are designed to just be to fulfill the letter of the law without trying to be effective. The other thing is the corrective ad. So part of what they're, again, what they're responsible to do is to underscore that they knew that smoking is addictive. They know that what they were doing was deceptive, and they knew that smoking caused cancer, nicotine was addictive. And so they're not anti-smoking ads per se, they're corrective ads. But even so, you know, I have freshmen who would do better than that, high school students. My middle school daughter could do better than that, but that's not what they're trying to do.
Yeah. So these ads are going to run five times a week, Monday through Thursday, between 7 and 10 p.m., CBS, NBC, ABC. There's full newspaper ads, full-page newspaper ads that first ran on November 26th. As I said, another will go out this Sunday, and for another 3 months across more than 50 papers, including the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune. Big Tobacco is footing the bill for this as part of the settlement. Eric, I want to ask you, though, how did the decisions about how and when the ads would run get made?
Well, ultimately, all of these were decided by the judge. What literally down to the black and white text, the size of the fonts, when they would run, and which one was going to be part of that, it was all part of the judge's order to ensure that the industry was following through and the companies were following through on what they were supposed to do. So all of this was very carefully negotiated. And it took clearly a long time to do it. But I think what is most important for your listeners to know is that the industry and these companies are not doing it voluntarily. They are doing it because a court ordered them to do so. And much of this is really making sure that educating the American public so that they can begin to understand that this fraud and deception has been going on for decades, and unless consumers realize that, it will continue. I think made a very interesting point. I mean, remember that this is an industry that got up in front of Congress. Many of the same companies which were convicted on these civil racketeering charges got up and lied to Congress in the 90s about whether or not nicotine was addictive. And so we really are seeing an industry that has lied to the American public, has lied to Congress about their products and a lot of the manipulation that has gone into them. And we are very pleased that at long last they are having to run these ads and to make sure that moving forward they are not able to do the same type of manipulation and racketeering that they have done up to now.
So we've only got about a minute left. Professor Wirtz, I want to ask you, will the necessary audience, I mean, we're talking primetime TV, major newspapers, will the necessary audience see these ads?
Well, again, I think it depends on who they're trying to, if it's a general corrective. We are required to tell the American public that we, in essence, committed fraud. But one thing that I'll just point out about the ads, it's almost like a boomerang effect in that the ads, because they're designed so poorly and they're so weird, it's drawing media attention and having the effect of actually drawing attention to the ads, and we're talking about them right now.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. I've been speaking with Erica Sward from the American Lung Association and Professor John Wirtz from the Department of Advertising at the University of Illinois. Thank you both for joining us on the 21st. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.